Fechando o ano. If forgiveness is the gift you give yourself when someone does you wrong, what can you give when the harm done to you is unforgivable? Hi, I'm James Carlton. Welcome to God Forbid on ABC Radio National and across the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia, the panel show about the things we believe. And it's hard to believe, but some families endure unspeakable harm and somehow remain intact, while others fracture over what seems like nothing at all. How do we hold space for the reality of suffering, even trauma, but also the possibility of redemption? Our culture justifies righteous anger. The victim must be vindicated, not blamed. But the question remains challenging for all of us, because perfect families simply don't exist, and any relationship worth having comes at a cost. To discuss this, a first-time welcome to Professor Michael Salter from the University of New South Wales. Hello, Michael.
Great to be with you.
And Dr. Karen Pack is back from the University of Notre Dame, Australia. Hey, Karen.
Hi, James. Great to be back.
So, Karen, with all your years of pastoral care and ministry and research and life, is this your experience that we hurt the ones we love the most?
Oh, sometimes it is. You can have a family where two people experience incredible pain and incredible trauma of a very, very similar sort, and yet their lives take two very different trajectories. And so I don't think that it's necessary to hurt the ones that you love, but yeah, sometimes we do by virtue of the fact that they're the people closest to us and they see us at our most vulnerable.
What do you think, Michael?
I think that's right. I think when we lash out, I think when we act out, I think it's the people in our surroundings who are most affected. And there's something about the vulnerability of family relationships and romantic relationships that as human beings we find really challenging. Mm-hmm. And that struggle with our vulnerability and our dependency on one another is so critical to so many social problems that we're trying to solve, I think.
Mm. If it's given rise to any issues that you need to talk about, you can call Lifeline. Michael, you're internationally recognized expert on violence and abuse. Do you want to share your story of how your interest began?
Look, I mean, I think I grew up with a very particular sensitivity around wrongdoing. There were people in my life who had been really impacted by trauma. And so I sort of went out into the world as a young person with an eye for it. And, you know, once you know what to look for, it's everywhere. And it's really hard to turn away from it. But as Karen said, there's these incredible stories of hope. Mm-hmm. And one of the great things about my job is coming across survivors, victims, professionals who have come from the most egregious circumstances, and yet, you know, who they are in their totality is just so incredible and transcendent. And it's really amazing to see. It's not everyone's story, and people get crushed and hurt by what happens to them, but it's so unpredictable. I mean, I've talked about this and written about this, but in my late teens, I trotted off to uni to a share house, and one of my flatmates was just clearly struggling, and she couldn't sleep. She had nightmares all night. She was really dissociative, but she was also this incredible person. She was incredibly bright. She was so emotionally empathetic. I think she was sort of the first person that I feel like I met in my life where I really just had this kind of like eye-to-eye kind of bond with, and to see her struggling like that and also realizing so many people around her knew that struggle and had never said, are you okay? So within a couple of months of getting to know her, those are the questions I asked. What happened to you? Are you okay? Because she'd been severely sexually abused. And this was the late 90s when, frankly, there was so little services, there was so little awareness, there was so little care for somebody like her, and a lot's changed. But it's really through the hard work of survivors like her that things have changed.
And Karen, we really have seen this global awakening about, slow though it's been, about the, you know, impact of violence and trauma, and it's changing still. What can you tell me about this?
Well, I think there has been, you know, as we've grown in this kind of global village and, you know, the interconnectedness of life these days, the courage of people that have been able to stand up and say, hey, this has happened to me. Or for some of us, the people in our, you know, close to us in our own circles, in our own families that have the courage to say what happened to them, there's a greater kind of visibility and there's a ripple effect that's happening with that. Where if you think back to, you know, my parents' generation and their parents before them, families were really very much a closed shop and you don't admit to the shame. And I think there's an awareness now that shame is not something that should be experienced alone. And it's not something that has to tar you permanently. And if you're experiencing shame as a result of some kind of an abuse, it's not actually because you're the problem, but you can seek help because of what's been done for you and you're able to speak out about the incredible harm that's happened. So is there a global awakening? Yes, I think there is because victim survivors have been speaking up. And that has led to more and more people being able to hear. And just like Michael explained, when you had that encounter with your housemate and it opened your eyes to how many people are going through that, often we can't recognise what's happening with the people around us or even ourselves actually until we hear someone else verbalise it. And because, you know, people can verbalise things on a global scale these days, there is that global awakening and it's giving people more and more courage. Now, for some people, it's also leading to an incredible resistance and determination to shut voices down. But for many people, it's that old thing of you can't be what you can't see. And for some people, they can see themselves as a survivor and as someone who's recovering from trauma and moving on with their life when they see someone else do that.
And Michael, because of the monsters in the world around us, the men like Jeffrey Epstein, we know what evil looks like. Does that come at a price, though, that we can, you know, put the problems of the world on the monster and ignore the monster in ourselves, in a sense?
My experience is that the people who can recognize the monstrous in others also need to understand that evil is, in a sense, a part of all of us. It's a part of human nature. The splitting that says, oh, look, you know, Jeffrey Epstein's a bad guy, I'm a good guy, I think is a mistake. I think it's better to understand someone like Epstein as a human being who's walked a path that is actually open to all of us. There is a great naivety in insisting that we do not have a perpetrating potential or a perpetrating part. We all experience impulses to hurt and to harm. We all experience narcissism and egoism. The human struggle is the struggle with those impulses, and some people lose that struggle. But when we deny it in ourselves, my experience is often we turn away from victims and survivors because they're telling us a story about human reality that we can't hear and we can't tolerate.
Yeah, I think that's something that I've seen a lot in churches, to be honest, because obviously a lot of my history is working in Christian organisations where far too often you see someone identified as a perpetrator, as an abuser, and leadership in the organisation just shuts it down because they would rather problematise and shame the victims of that person than actually hold them to account. And yet there are those who call, you know, the naming of that evil, the naming of that abuse, and they'll point to it and go, that's satanic, that's a demonic attack, rather than go, wow, how do we allow this to flourish in our midst and what can we do to prevent it happening going forward? That too often that reflects our inability to struggle with our own darkness and to admit the problematic nature that we have ourselves, yeah.
But isn't it fair to say, I can self-righteously say, I will never be a Jeffrey Epstein or I will never hit a woman and I believe I never will?
You certainly hope so, but you know, talk to me about the number of victims of abuse who are terrified of becoming that person, who are terrified of becoming a perpetrator, that see that perpetrator potential, as you called it, and are terrified of that coming out of themselves because of what they themselves have experienced. And I've seen that up close with people who are very precious to me and very close to me, who have experienced horrendous, horrendous abuse and are terrified of becoming perpetrators themselves. And sometimes they're driven into such a place of shame and the fear of telling people about their experiences that they inadvertently ultimately do become abusive, possibly in different ways, in other ways that they might become volatile or dangerous in a range of other ways, because they haven't found a safe space to be able to talk about that. And I myself, like I've gone through different experiences of abuse and trauma. I won't go into that today, but I remember one time having a conversation with a therapist where he said to me, you need to understand that the experience of trauma doesn't, you know, repeating that trauma, of you repeating that on someone else, taking that about on someone else, that's not a necessary correlation. But he said to me, but it does make you hypervigilant. It makes you very alert to the risks. And so it can be that you kind of turn that lens back on yourself and you're policing yourself, policing your own behavior and vigilant for that in yourself and also in others. So you become very alert of the signs of potential for abuse in other people and very sensitive to that. Would you agree?
100%. And, you know, particularly for, you know, abuse and trauma, early abuse, it activates that alarm system that we all have that's designed to protect us. But once that alarm system is turned on permanently, which for some victims and survivors it is, it leads that hypervigilance and that protectiveness. And it's really important to understand, you know, proximity to abuse, that's what it does. It turns on our protective capability. And sometimes that gets warped into violence and abuse. Yeah. Part of sitting with victims and survivors and people that have experienced abuse is really looking at how we support that protective capacity back to the place where it should be, you know, back to a healthy place, back to a strong place. It's a very strong part of us, I think, that's activated in defense against abuse. And it requires humility in the bystander. When we, again, when we deny that dark side of ourselves, then we can't sit with victims and survivors who are aware of that darkness. They've been forced into proximity to it. We need to be able to say, that's a part of me as well. I'm here with you. You're not alone with this aspect of yourself.
On Radio National, God Forbid, we are with Professor Michael Salter from the University of New South Wales, the director of the Australasian Hub of Childlight, the Global Child Safety Institute, also Dr. Karen Pack, lecturer at the University of Notre Dame, Australia. We're looking at the good and bad in all of us, the evil in the worst of us, and the light that still shines in the best of us. Michael, I'm still not fully understanding the connection between evil people and quote-unquote normal people.
Evil is a really strong word. I think it's actually an important word. And when I talk about evil in my work, and I do talk about evil, I'm talking about human beings who predate on vulnerability, who predate on the interdependence that is the fabric of human life. I work in child sexual abuse, and there really is no greater example of human vulnerability than a child, but we're all vulnerable in certain respects. And there is a class or a cohort of people who manipulate vulnerability, attack vulnerability, and get some enjoyment from this. And what distinguishes that from other sorts of wrongdoing, because I don't think all forms of harm and abuse is evil in that sense, is its attack on, I think, the fabric of human existence, that without which we can't survive. Part of my work is also acknowledging that some people have walked a path or their lives have taken a form that I actually cannot understand. Psychologically, they are over the horizon from what you and I can realistically relate to. There's a psychoanalyst called Sue Grand who wrote a book in 2000 called The Reproduction of Evil. And she talks about how, in Heideggerian terms, human beings are sort of thrown into the world. It's like a meteor. You kind of hit the ground. And in your encounter with reality, bits and pieces of your possibility split off. You know, you could be lots of many, you know, a one-month-old baby can be many, many different things. Mm. And over the course of your life, that possibility is pruned. You start to become the person that you are, and you can't be the people that you're not, basically.
People play this game. What would have happened if this happened to Hitler when he was a baby? That happened to Hitler when he was six.
That's right, yeah. But she said, it's this line, I'm paraphrasing, but she said, sometimes the murderer is the only part that survives. And there are times in my work where I'm dealing with someone or dealing with a case where I'm sorry, this person's not coming back from where they've gone and I can't meet them where they're at because I don't understand them anymore. That's an extreme case. I think most people, when they engage in abuse and harm and violence, we're able to find some position whereby at least we understand what drove them, even if we don't agree with it. But that sense of humility, that sense of humbleness, and by that I mean that we are not impervious to the impulses that drive people to engage in harm, is something that is really important to hold close. And again, because so many victims and survivors really do have to grapple with the reality of that.
Yeah.
And we can't abandon them to that. People hold multitudes, in the words of Walt Whitman, and people can be legitimately, I think, a good, kind, caring person and a perpetrator at the same time.
Yeah.
And those can be two parts of them that are contradictory, that are not integrated, that do not make sense.
Yeah.
And we can hold a relationship with both parts of them, but also hold them accountable in their totality. And I think that's a dialectic that is very challenging, but very human.
Yeah, that's something that I've personally grappled with a lot. I actually spoke to my brother before this session and said, should I talk about this? Maybe not too much. But his comment was like, hey, Dad made it known what happened to him. So here we go. My dad was a victim of horrendous abuse when he was a very young man. And that was from someone who, you know, had been a representative of the church, who'd actually left the church through a variety of experiences, but inflicted just horrendous, horrendous abuse on him in every way imaginable. And when he finally got to the point, my father, that is, got to the point of actually going to someone and seeking help from another church leader, that person then became his next abuser. So we're talking about layers of horrendous, horrendous abuse. And what that meant for, you know, my family when I was growing up was my dad was a pretty volatile person and he was scary in a bunch of ways. And that played out in all sorts of ways, but he was a very, very volatile person. And only a couple of years ago, my dad actually passed away. And I had many people coming up to me because my dad, what I didn't mention is that my dad was also a church leader, that he was an ordained minister for over 50 years in a whole bunch of places throughout Australia and New Zealand and internationally. And in those roles, he had a profound impact on other people, including some people who were themselves victims of sexual abuse, who he really helped to find the light and to recover from some of what they've experienced. And so after he died, I had people coming to me just saying, your dad had the most incredible impact on me. Your dad was a great preacher. Your dad lectured me at Bible college and it was the most profound experience of my life. He's just had this incredibly healing experience, these people were saying to me. And yet I'd been grappling my whole life with the volatility of my father and with, you know, growing up as an evangelical Christian, that imperative to always forgive and what that means. I'd wrestled with that my whole life. And I'd come to a point where I had a relationship with my father that was a good relationship, but there was always that struggle. And it took my dad dying and hearing what these people had to say for me to finally realize, you know what, my dad was a dangerous man in a whole bunch of ways, a very angry man, and he could be quite an abusive person. He was also a great preacher, a great teacher, and an incredibly healing influence in the lives of many people. He was both those things. And it was so liberating for me to realize that, you know, sometimes we want people to be one or the other.
We need them to be one or the other.
But they're both, just like I'm both.
But what your father suffered as a child means we can understand what happened afterwards. What you suffered as a child means we can't forgive what was done to you. What do we do when it's one person?
I mean, there's a famous quote, and you alluded to another version of it at the beginning, that when you choose not to forgive someone, you sentence someone to life in prison and that person is you. Mm. So there's, you know, that aspect of things. I think there's a difference between forgiving someone in the sense of going, I'm not going to allow what you did to me to rule my life anymore. I'm not going to allow it to dominate my thinking and my personality and whatever. And actually, I'm going to allow myself to see that there are glimpses of light in you. That is not the same as excusing what they did. So another situation that I know of where, you know, a family, two children in the family experience horrendous, horrendous abuse. One of those children grows up to be a very volatile, dangerous person. The other one grows up to be one of the safest people I've ever known in my life. the same home, the same experiences of abuse, two very different paths in life. So I think there is, if you are someone who has experienced abuse, there is an accountability for the choices that you make. Like, yes, we've got that potential. Yes, there's that potential for evil in us. And yes, all of us, you know, hurt people at times, as we've said, but there's an accountability for that. It's when we let ourselves off the hook for accountability, that's when evil flourishes. And that's the kind of thing I'm pointing to when I point to someone like a Jeffrey Epstein or some of the church leaders where scandal has broken out in recent times, where it's become very, very obvious that abuse flourished under their leadership. But it's when people are excused from their abuse of others, that's when evil flourishes, in my mind. And it's not, it is not your destiny. If you've experienced abuse or trauma, it is not your destiny to repeat that. There are choices. You are accountable for those choices.
I think when we talk about forgiveness, from my point of view, I think about it as a kind of a radical acceptance that says this really bad thing that shouldn't have happened definitely happened, and we have to deal with the consequences. And also the person who perpetrated that harm, this is who they are in their totality. And from that point of view, I think it's actually really important to meet perpetration with a kind of force. I mean, it has to be stopped. But it also has to be acknowledged. And when there's that premature excusing of someone, when there's like premature, we understand and you had this background and so on and so forth, we're refusing to see that side of them that inflicted that harm and maybe enjoyed it and chose it. And that that part of them is sitting there. So I think meeting perpetration with an appropriate response, and that's a criminal justice response, that's going to prison, that's punishment, I think that matters. Because it registers not just what was done to the victim, but it registers that part of that person that inflicted that harm. But that's not all that that person is. And our demand that people be one thing is a problem. You know, some victims and survivors and sometimes people in the community will say, well, like the good part of the perpetrator was a front, it was a fake. And the bad part of the perpetrator was the real part. And if you believe in the good part of this person, then you've been taken in by them. But it suggests that they're kind of like Machiavellian geniuses who are going through the world manipulating people. And frankly, there are some Machiavellian people who go through the world. That's not most offenders. And I think at a policy level, that's where we need to be able to hold the line that says you are accountable for what you've done and you're accountable for breaking the social contract. And if there is another side to you that we can nurture and we can support, I think there can also be some collective responsibility taking that says for a lot of people that are harming, we didn't protect you when you were kids. We weren't there. We didn't hold your perpetrators accountable, and we're only stepping in now that you're harming someone else. That's the first time that the state seems to be interested in intervening. So I think there's a collective responsibility piece as well that says, yes, you're responsible for your actions, but we are responsible for the fact that you got to this point. And how have we failed as a society?
Well, what about the example, say, of a man who is violent with his wife and the cycle of anger becoming rage, of guilt becoming toxic shame, remorse, broken promises, violence, repeat. Is this a cycle you see?
It's a very common cycle in domestic violence. And frankly, first and foremost, our obligation is to protect their victims and to stop the behaviour. And that's what I mean about meeting perpetration with force. I mean, there needs to be a forceful response. And it's been interesting over the last 5 or 6 years, there's been a real grappling, obviously, with police force, and we're having that debate. But there's also a kind of naivety that says we can have harmful and violent people in our midst and only deliver a therapeutic response. To my mind, that is, again, an abrogation of our responsibilities to both victims but also to perpetrators. We will always need, because human nature is such that we will always need to step in to stop this sort of conduct. And at that time, you know, the internal life of the perpetrator is really not first and foremost. We'll attend to that later once we've kept people safe.
What about, Karen, this cultural approach we've been taking to that, sending out the message that, you know, real men don't hit women. It's cowardly for a man to harm a child. This was something Tony Abbott explicitly said when he was Prime Minister.
I think there's one of the positive signs I see in society these days is addressing our understanding of masculinity, and that masculinity is a very, very broad category, and it's not definitively toxic and it's not definitively beautiful either, that there's a spectrum of masculinity and the way in which you choose to exercise that is very, very important. That concept that real men don't hit, I think for some people, the message just completely misses. And it can drive people to deny the impulse within themselves or to reinterpret their behaviours towards other people. So when they are violent or when they do something abusive to someone else, instead of recognising, oh, crap, that is me. I do have that potential. You know, I'm a potentially dangerous person. And in fact, I am a dangerous person. Instead of admitting that and holding accountability, because there's a shame around masculinity in some contexts, they deny it and they reinterpret it. And so sometimes that actually, in a weird kind of way, can reinforce victim shaming. Because for some people, it reinforces for them, I would never normally do that. I'm not that kind of person. But she made me, they made me in this context. They drew this evil out of me. It's not my fault. And so there's such a drive to be one or the other and to believe the best about ourselves. For me, one of the greatest drivers of abuse and abusive behaviors is shame and, you know, not allowing people to genuinely come into the light and reveal the struggles that they're having with who they are and not to be able to name, you know, actually, you know what? I was in this situation recently where stuff happened and I got really churned up and I was really tempted to hit my partner. Like, for a guy to say that, the appropriate response is not to shame him necessarily, but to go, wow, how did you feel? What did you do? And if you did do the wrong thing, you need to be held accountable for it. And we need to talk about how you're going to make a different choice next time and actually address that. So there are different pathways available. But when we drive people into silence, it drives them deeper into shame. And in my experience, shame is one of the number one drivers that precedes abuse and attack of other people.
I'm reminded of this Look What You Made Me Do series made by Jess Hill on SBS, your friend who you've worked with. Can this be what happens when shame is put into the equation?
It's really interesting. You know, Jess, one of the chapters in her book is actually about the link between shame and violence. Mm. And it was such a controversial link for her to make at the time. There was a lot of backlash and it provoked a lot of thought. And I think as the dust has settled, it settled well in the sense of people really acknowledging the role of shame in men's violence. Yeah. I think shame is often our response to a part of ourself that we can't tolerate. Mm-hmm. And for violent men, what we want to promote is their ability to make that approach to that part of themselves where the violence is held. And often there is shame, humiliation, trauma, all sorts of things that sit there. In New Zealand, the organisation She Is Not Your Rehab has been a really interesting one about saying, okay, you've got problems, things have happened to you, but you don't get to take that out on your wife. You don't get to take that out on your girlfriend. You need to take responsibility for that. Yes, it happened to you, but it's your job. And we'll help you with your job, but we're not going to excuse this behaviour. So I think there's ways to speak to that inner experience that men and boys have around violence, recognizing, frankly, violence is a leading cause of injury and death to men and boys. It is the primary reason of early mortality for boys and men, men 18 to 24. You know, one woman is killed every week by men, two men are killed every week by other men. And the women's movement's done a fantastic job of mobilizing around men's violence against women, and men have done a terrible job about mobilizing around our own violence, because to a certain extent we glorify it, we idealize it, we invest in men's aggression as a source of pride.
Well, that comes back to the real men thing.
That's right.
The problem with that message isn't saying necessarily real men don't hit. It's the implication that real men need an outlet for some kind of violent response.
Another man.
It might be another man, right? And then you get back to the boys will be boys and all that kind of crap. Like, that just is so, it is toxic and it is so damaging.
And real men do hit women, and real men don't hit women. They're all real men.
I think that is the hidden message in Real Men Don't Hit Women is, you know, the men who hit women are imaginary. You know, they're not there. You don't need to pay attention to them. You don't need to worry about them. They're not in your backyard. They're not next door because you live with the real men.
But it's easy to, again, make out the monster in the other so you don't have to look at it in yourself. Take coercive control. On one level, it's being criminalised across Australia. That's great. The torture, psychological torture of coercive control must have consequences. But on another level, which relationship are we in that is completely free of guilt tripping or at least some level of manipulation?
I think coercive control represents an extreme example of our inability and certain people's inability to live with basic interdependence. What does it mean for two people to exist for one another as people, as subjects, trying to find their way through life together as two people? And instead, in coercive control, we have one person who insists, I'm the subject, I'm the person, and you're an object. You're my object. You exist for me, for my purposes. And when you act like a human being, when you act like a person, I cannot tolerate that. That is fundamentally threatening to me because I don't know how to be close to someone if I'm not in control. I think it's the collapse of interdependence into a subject-object relationship that is just fundamentally anti-human. And for people who live their life in that mode, I feel so sorry for them because they don't understand the best parts of a human life. Sometimes in the domestic violence field, people say, you know, it's coercive control. It's how men get what they want. I don't understand. I actually don't understand that belief.
Yeah.
Because that's not what human beings want. It's not what human beings need. Yeah, it's not the conditions of human flourishing. The conditions of human flourishing are love and affection and care, and men need that just as much as anyone else. Yeah. And so coercive control is such a diminished and barren form of existence, as much as it is so destructive to the people who are caught up in it. For the offender, that's not a human life.
But Karen, when we try to find the line between healthy and unhealthy, criminal and not criminal, do we forget that it's a spectrum which we're all on? Can we draw a hard and fast line between control and manipulation that is harmful and that which isn't?
I don't think we can. I don't think it's as simple as that. If we try and make a hard and fast line, then it's easy, A, for people to excuse themselves and say, but I haven't done that, and for us to ignore all the cues leading up to that. You know, and we know that statistic of the number of women who are killed every week by intimate partners. And so often in the wake of the murder, we discover in the weeks going on that she had sought help from police, from services, who have said, we can't do anything until you cross this line. Now that is, honestly, that makes me want to vomit. There are so many signs that lead up to that, and we have to get better at recognizing them and addressing them and giving them resources. And we have to get better at educating the police in how to recognize those signs in others and in themselves, actually, so that those lines aren't crossed, that we're addressing things before we come up. To me, a lot of that is about emotional responsibility and what are healthy and unhealthy responses to situations before they cross a line of violence or abuse. What does it look like to admit that I'm feeling this emotion that actually that's pretty dark and that's pretty dangerous? Certainly, this is something that I saw in my father growing up when he felt something ugly in himself or when he felt ashamed of a behavior. He'd withdraw into himself and he would make it other people's responsibility to make him feel better. To tell him you're not a terrible person, you're not an evil person, you know, you're more than whatever's just happened. And so in that sense, he refused to take emotional responsibility for himself and he put that onto the people that were around him in his family. That's an incredibly abusive behavior, an incredibly coercive behavior. To address that when you first see it happening, to be able to name in our close relationships, I'm feeling manipulated right now, or to be able to go, oh my goodness, what I just said was really manipulative. Before it gets to that point, that's really, really important. The safest relationship I have in my life is my relationship with my wife. Nothing is hidden from her. And one of the things that makes that an incredibly safe relationship and a refuge is not just the fact that we can watch the Winter Olympics at 10 o'clock at night and giggle at people on the luge, but that when things are tense in our house, that we can look at one another in the midst of a conversation and go, I'm really sorry. That was a manipulative thing for me to say, and I shouldn't have said that. Or come back 5 minutes, 10 minutes later and go, I feel manipulated by what you just said, and to be able to talk that through. It's that being able to name something when it comes up as a feeling, when it comes up as a response, that's what makes our relationship safe. Not the fact that she's never been an abusive person and she's never hit someone, she's never. It's not that. It's the fact that both of us recognize in ourselves that there are a whole bunch of steps that lead up to the across the line behavior, if you want to call it that. And so we pull that line all the way back to taking responsibility for our own emotions and our own reactions.
Michael, what do you say to that?
I think that point about emotional regulation is really critical. We get born into these bodies that are just full of drives and impulses and feelings, and they're really overwhelming. And research, pediatric research, is really interesting in terms of like the trajectory of kids' violence. Kids get born and have to learn not to be violent, to be honest. And, you know, up to the age of sort of 10, you just see this slow reduction in kids' use of violence. It's actually pretty gender symmetrical as well. Like boys and girls, if you've ever grown up with sisters, which I have, boys and girls sort of equally violent. And there's sort of this reduction to the age of 10 because kids are learning those lessons about how do I manage conflict differently, so on and so forth. Unfortunately, not all kids get those lessons. And, you know, one in four Australian children will grow up being exposed to domestic violence. One in three Australian children will be sexually abused before the age of 18. And so trauma has a disintegrating and eroding effect on how we pull ourselves together as people. And of course, culture is there as well, because what we also start to see really from the age of 10 is also the impact of culture on men and boys, boys' use of violence, and the way it gets normalised and excused. So there's a real task in front of us as people, but also as a society, about being stuck with these feelings and these drives and these impulses and putting them to good use. And what I would say for myself is I think my work often makes me really angry, and it often makes me really, really upset. And I have to find a way to take that impulse and channel it. It's got to go somewhere.
Yep, that's right.
And you can do a lot with it, actually, but you've got to admit that it's there. And then you've got to give it a job, basically. And that's our responsibility to young people as well. You know, we talk about intergenerational trauma, and that is there. You know, I do work with people where they can talk about their grandparent and their parent and then themselves and then their kids and their grandkids, and they can see this line. But like, intergenerational resilience is there as well.
Yes.
You know, this inheritance from your grandparents and great-grandparents that maybe you don't know, but that's also the effect that you can have. And you'll never know the effect that you'll have. You'll never know what people inherit from you, because, you know, your resilience, your values, your implicit example that you set, that also has a ripple effect. So I think sometimes people feel powerless. They feel like they can't make a difference in the world. And from my vantage point, it's actually really simple, which is be a good person and do your best, and you'll probably leave the world a better place than you found it.
Tell me about this and your personal spiritual journey. You came to Buddhism from your work in researching child sexual assault.
That is true. So about sort of 20 years ago, it was becoming apparent that trauma therapy for survivors, when it was integrated with certain practices and lessons from Buddhist teaching, was much more effective than standard therapy. And at the time, I was on the board for an organisation for survivors, and we were looking for low-cost, low-risk treatment options for survivors. And so I was working with some psychologists who delivered this form of treatment. And they said to me, look, if you want to know what we do, you should just go to a meditation class, and it'll probably be good for you anyway. And so I went to a class about 20 years ago, and just kept going. It was taught by a Buddhist nun. I was just really taken by the commitment that she'd made. Actually, as quite a young person, to the Buddhist path. And after a couple of years, signed up for classes. So I used to go to the temple for 4 hours on a Sunday, did that for about 12 years, started teaching meditation. In the context of my work, I often feel a bit like, this is a really strange analogy, but it feels like a spacesuit. My work is really toxic. I'm right. in environments, thinking about things, dealing with things that are so sort of anti-human. Mm. And for me, Buddhist practice and faith was like putting on a spacesuit so that I could exist in that environment and live in it in a sustainable way and do the good that I wanted to do in that environment without it taking me down.
Yeah, I once used a similar and different analogy of like the full surgical PPE that you put on, or the gown and the mask and the gloves and the everything, so that you can engage, but then you can take it off when you walk out of that room so that you can be free. Obviously, my experience is very different to yours from a pastoral and chaplaincy perspective, sitting with both perpetrators and survivors. But yeah, it is very much that you need a space where you can take it off and process, yeah.
And yet, Karen, you've seen the very worst that churches can do. Why would you want to stay with that? Why wouldn't you take the path that so many do, which is say, these hypocrites have nothing to offer me?
Yeah. Well, the answer to that is that I couldn't stay in church the way that it was, the way that I experienced it growing up. I just couldn't. But it's not just that as well. It's the broader institutions and structures. I remember very, very clearly when I was giving a lecture on biblical ethics at a Bible college here in Sydney, and I was asking students to look at a very well-known theology text by a guy called Stan Grenz, who wrote Theology for the Community of God, where he talks about the love of God necessitating the justice of God. So this is a passage where he's explaining why hell, an eternal conscious punishment, is a theological necessity. And the night before, I'd been sitting with one of the women from my church as she talked to me about her experience of domestic violence and how her husband would say to her, it's your fault that I'm doing this. And, you know, I'm doing this to teach you a lesson, and I'm reading this theological account by a very well-known, very highly respected evangelical theologian, and I'm reading this account of God's love necessitating the violence of punishment and hell, and going, that's exactly the same thing as I heard last night. That's exactly the same thing as I've heard from people justifying violence against children. And I just could not sit with it anymore. It had been a slow build. So the answer is I can't. I can't be in those kind of churches anymore, James, and I won't be a part of them. What I will be a part of is churches that center the person of Jesus and the teachings of Jesus about nonviolence and about holding people accountable, the liberating way of love and justice and forgiveness that does not excuse evil, that does not excuse unrighteousness, holds people accountable for it, but refuses to practice it, to sweep it under the rug, all of those kind of things. So yeah, I will still go to those churches and speak at those churches if they've got a commitment to genuinely walking in the light in that sense. But I won't. I will not be a part of churches that oppress, whether through their leadership structures, their systems, or their theology, because it's a slippery slope.
And Michael, tell me about this ability we have in humans to convince ourselves we're not doing anything wrong or we're justified in the things we do.
I think about this in terms of splitting. I think about this in terms of our defense mechanisms, our coping mechanisms, and there is kind of an infantile or childish way of going through the world. Things are either good or bad. So I think this is often activated in response to witnessing abuse, our own perpetration. And we see this defense in perpetrators all the time. If I've done something bad, it must be because of you. You must be the bad person. I can't be the bad person. And so being able to hold that mature position that says we're all a mix of good and bad and we're all flawed. And I think in a theological or an existential sense, we're all broken, is one way I might put it, as human beings. We're not perfectible. There's no state that we can reach whereby we will be expunged of the impulse for harm or the impulse to do wrong. So we can think about that as a type of humility. And I came across, it's an old Roman quote. I'm not going to embarrass myself by trying to remember who said it. But the quote was, you know, I'm a human and nothing human is alien to me. And it really struck me in the context of my work and thinking about some of the behaviour that I study, which feels really alien to me, but not accepting that as the final answer, that there are parts of us, there are shadows to us that will always be alien to us. That doesn't mean they're not there.
Yeah, the shadow self thing is quite a helpful analogy, isn't it?
Mm.
There is a shadow side to me, that there is a dark side of me that exists and it's there and it's a part of me and you can't separate from that any more than you can, you know, ask your shadow to go and stand over there. Thank you very much. But it's an awareness of that and how that operates.
On Radio National, this is God Forbid. I'm James Carlton. We're with Michael Salter from the University of New South Wales and Dr. Karen Pack from the University of Notre Dame, Australia. Look, we're talking about the good and bad in all of us, the evil in some of us, the light that's in the best of us. If it's given rise to any issues that you need to talk about, you can call Lifeline or 1-800-RESPECT, another option, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. To wrap up, I just want to ask you, each in your own ways, you both see the best and the worst that humanity has to offer. How do you deal with, you know, the despair and I hope that comes with that? And what change do you want to see?
For me, I really enjoy a conscious practice of delight.
Mm-hmm.
You know, really taking the time to enjoy people in all their specificity and in all the different parts of them, and taking the time to find the things in people that I admire that I don't think that I have. I would like some of those qualities. But I think what counterbalances sometimes sitting with the darkness and sitting with the difficult aspects of the work is the delight, and also I think the awe that we can find in other people and in what they make of their lives despite everything that they've been through. And there is something ineffable about that. I really enjoy the fact that I sometimes just cannot explain how people became who they were. They should never have been able to survive. They should never have been able to construct the life that they've constructed. And that gives me faith in something. It gives me faith in something. I can't name it. I can't touch it. I can't measure it. You can't study it, but it's there. And that's what gets me out of bed in the morning.
You really see it every day. The people suffering unimaginable things and magic coming in spite of it in unimaginable ways.
There is a risk that we only notice what is breaking down and we take for granted the glue and the gravity that holds people together.
Mm.
And that is the air that we breathe, you know, the love that people have for each other, the small acts of kindness that they give to each other, the effort that we are engaged in every single day just to get along and be good people. And sometimes our attention is grabbed by the big things and the bad things and it feels really hopeless, but we need to pay deliberate attention to the fundamental goodness in people, because that is what's there every day. We only notice it when it's not there. We only notice it when that compact is violated. We can't take it for granted, because we can work with it, we can strengthen it, we can build on it. We can have faith in it. It works. And it's the only reason why we're still here. If we had to give back today everything that other people have given to us, we would have nothing. We would have no clothes. We would have no food. We'd have no water. We wouldn't have a cell in our body, because everything that we have, other people have worked to give to us. Mm. And those innumerable people didn't know our name, didn't do it for us personally. They did it because that's what human beings do, and that's who we are. And as long as we keep a laser focus on that, and yes, hold people accountable when they violate those relationships, when they predate on those relationships, they are a danger to the human collective. But there's also a danger in exiling them, because I think when we do that, we're exiling a part of ourselves as well.
Yeah, our unavoidable interdependence, Karen. We have a choice to make a gift of it or a punishment.
Oh, yeah. Interdependence is an incredibly beautiful gift in so many ways. And I think, I mean, for me, one of the key things that you spoke about there, Michael, was about gratitude. You know, it's one of the practices that Bronte and I have incorporated is that when we have dinner together in the evening, we just hold each other's hand and each of us names something that we're grateful for. She works in a context where she sees a lot of trauma and a lot of pretty full-on stuff often every day. And I work in a context where I am both teaching about some very, very traumatic things that have happened in our history and often have students and staff coming to me to process stuff that they've identified through all of that in themselves or in their families. And so you need to have a space that you deliberately make in your day, in your life, where you see the beauty and the wonder of everything that's around you. Another thing that we do is I'm unapologetically picky about the people in my world these days. I think as someone who's been, you know, a pastor for 30 years, pastor and a missionary and a chaplain and all of those kind of things, for a long time I thought that there was a sense in which the world kind of owned me. And certainly in the work that I do and making myself available to people, I do that. But in my personal life, I'm really picky about the people that are in my circle. And they are people that are accountable for themselves and their choices, that take emotional responsibility. But they're people that are kind. They're people that laugh really easily and can see the humor in things. And they're people that don't buy into the cancel culture of our world. Because I think cancel culture is one of those reflexes where we write people off really quickly. We discover a bad thing that they've said or done in their past, and we make that cancel everything else that they've done, all that they are up until now, because of something that they did 5, 10, 20 years ago. And I just think that's a naive and an unhelpful thing, and that all of us are at risk of that, actually, if people, you know, discovered the thoughts that we have or the things that we might have said. And I said things, you know, 10, 20 years ago that I in no way agree with now.
10 minutes ago in my case.
Yeah, that's right. There we go. And so it's, you know, holding myself in relationship, in close relationship with people that are people of kindness and people of grace, that are accountable for their actions, but also know how to, in Christian parlance, repent, you know, to genuinely take responsibility for that and turn 180 degrees and walk in a new direction once you realize that you've been operating out of hurt or dysfunction, to choose a new way. And those are people that help me to find wonder and beauty and gratitude in my world.
Well, it's still a time for hope. This has been God Forbid. Thank you for your company this week, and thank you to our guests, Karen Pack. Her new book is Queer Omissions, Unmarried Women and Social Justice Activism in the Church. Thank you, Karen.
Thank you, James. It's been great to be here.
She's a lecturer at the University of Notre Dame, Australia, and Michael Salter is professor at the University of New South Wales. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, James.
He's director, too, of the Australasian Hub of Childlight, the Global Child Safety Institute. And, you know, just a reminder, if the ideas in this program have given rise to any concerns you want to talk about, do call 1-800-RESPECT. A big thanks to producer Amanda Roberts, sound engineer Antonia Gauci. I'm James Carlton. Until next week, remember to be good. This has been God Forbid.